This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. A top NATO official says the Western military alliance is no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from having robust posture in Eastern Europe. Iran strongly condemns desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by, quote, racist Zionists, urging the world to counter the apartheid regime of Israel. Plus, Colombia's leftist Gustavo Petro tops the first round of the country's presidential election and will face an independent challenger in the runoff. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. NATO says it's no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from deploying its forces in Eastern Europe. The alliance's deputy secretary general says Russia's decisions to attack Ukraine and halt dialogue with NATO shows it has effectively moved away from the terms of a 1997 agreement between the alliance and Moscow. Under that agreement, the two sides had agreed to work to prevent any potentially threatening buildup of conventional forces in Central and Eastern Europe. Mircea Janna said the alliance now has no restrictions to have robust presence in the eastern flank to ensure its territory is protected. Janna didn't give details of any planned deployment. NATO sent some troops to the Baltic states and Poland in 2017. It also sent reinforcements there following Russia's operation in Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow pursues what he calls the liberation of Ukraine's Donbass as an unconditional priority. Lavrov says other Ukrainian territories should decide on their future on their own. His comments come after Russia intensified its shelling to seize Severodonetsk, which is the largest city under Ukrainian control in Donbass. Russian forces are now trying to encircle the key city. They also destroyed command posts in missile strikes on two towns near Severodonetsk Sunday. The Russian military earlier said they captured the nearby city of Lyman. Though that account was challenged by Ukrainian officials, Russia is now focused on seizing the entire eastern Ukrainian regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Moscow says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia populations there. Iran has condemned Israeli forces' desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and their attacks on Palestinians there. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh warned against Tel Aviv's latest adventurism and provocative moves. He praised Palestinian people's resistance against the regime and recalled the Palestinian cause the top priority of the Muslim world. He said all freedom-seeking people around the world, especially the people and governments of Muslim countries, have a duty to join hands to wholeheartedly defend Al-Quds and stand up to the apartheid Israeli regime. The spokesman also called on the international community and organizations to fulfill their legal responsibility by stopping Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli settlers have held their flag march in occupied Al-Quds city, despite prior warnings by Palestinians who see the parade as provocative. The settlers crossed the Damascus Gate and marched through the old city's Muslim quarter amid Palestinians' warning of retaliation. Mono Kandil has more from Ramallah.
Some 30,000 Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim slogans as part of what's known by Israel as the Flag March that takes place annually to celebrate its occupation of the eastern parts of the Holy City in 1967. Thousands also marched through the Muslim quarter of the old town of Al-Quds amid security deployment and restrictions against the Palestinians. Clashes broke out at the Bab al-Amud, known also as the Damascus Gate, multiple times ahead of the march. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces.
Israel is conducting a very dangerous policy. They are trying to impose the annexation of East Jerusalem, which presents a very serious violation of international law. The only way to stop the Israelis is to resist their actions, but also it is required from the whole international community to impose sanctions on Israel.
At the same time, Palestinians held counter-rallies across the occupied territories, waving the Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site.
By allowing the settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Israeli regime is trying to divert attention from its internal conflict and shift attention to the Judaization of Al-Quds. But it will fail because Al-Quds always unites all the Palestinian people. Today, we're all united for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Ahead of the march, in the morning, some 2,500 settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in groups of 40 to 50 under the protection of Israeli forces. Following that, Palestinian worshippers were attacked and forced out of the compound by the regime forces.
Some around the world could argue that it's only a flag parade and nothing more. But for Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation, domination, and seizure of their right to exist on their homeland. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has praised the Iraqi parliament's recent decision that criminalizes any forms of normalization with the Israeli regime. Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The Iraqi premier said his government and parliament have outlined a number of measures to support Palestinians and their cause. Kadhimi underlined that the issue of Palestine is not just restricted to Muslims, but to all who seek justice in the world. On Thursday, the Iraqi parliament unanimously approved legislation making it illegal to have any kind of relations with Israel. The move comes at a time when some Arab countries have formally established ties with the Israeli regime, despite opposition at home and abroad. A high-ranking Israeli official has visited Saudi Arabia and met with a senior Saudi official, fueling speculation that the two sides could be taking reciprocal steps toward the normalization of their relations. But this is not the first contact of its kind. It's an open secret that Riyadh and Tel Aviv have had an unofficial behind-the-scenes relationship and have even coordinated security-related issues in the past.
A senior Israeli official has traveled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said, "Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally," saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on stolen Palestinian land, He said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation-state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor Eyal Hulata is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause.
Saudi Arabia, like other Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf, has kept its relationship with Israel under wraps for some time. The monarchy has not recognized Israel since its occupation of Palestinian land back in 1948. And traditionally, Riyadh's official policy towards the Middle East, or towards the Middle East conflict, has been supportive of Palestinian Arabs and against Israel. But just like any other Persian Gulf Arab state, Saudi Arabia has failed to take any actual steps that would promote the cause of Palestine.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi crown prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel has usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and used the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
Colombia's presidential election heads to a runoff as front runners are well short of the 50% of votes needed to win the first round. With more than 96% of ballot boxes counted, leftist Gustavo Petro has secured over 40%. He is followed by his independent challenger Rodolfo Hernandez with just above 28%, while conservative politician Federico Gutierrez has garnered 24%. The runoff is slated for June 19th. Petro is an ex-mayor of Bogota and a former member of a guerrilla movement. He has vowed profound economic and social reforms if elected. Hernandez campaigned on an anti-graft platform. Almost 39 million Colombians were eligible to vote. Poverty, unemployment, and corruption, as well as rural violence, remain voters' main concerns. Sudan's army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, lifts a state of emergency that has been in place nationwide since a military coup last October. The country's transitional sovereign council says the decision was taken to create conditions for a fruitful dialogue to achieve peace and stability. On Sunday, a security body attached to the ruling council also recommended that all those who were detained following the coup should be released. The African nation has been the scene of frequent protests against the military takeover, with protesters demanding a return to civilian rule. Security forces often resorted to force and detained opposition politicians and figures connected to the protests. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will not wait for U.S. permission to launch a new cross-border offensive into Syria. Erdogan said Turkey would get along with the incursion on its own if Washington Court does not do its part in the fight against terrorism. That after the U.S. warned Turkey against launching a new incursion, saying the uneasy NATO ally would be putting American troops at risk. On Monday, Erdogan said Turkey would soon launch a new military operation into northern Syria to create a 30-kilometer quote-unquote security zone along the border. Turkey has launched three incursions into Syria since 2016 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Damascus has repeatedly slammed Turkey for its illegal presence in Syria, saying Ankara is supporting terrorists in northern Syria. In Sri Lanka, scuffles have broken out between police and medical students trying to storm the official residence of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa. Police used water cannon and tear gas to prevent protesting students from breaking down barriers across a road leading to the presidential palace in Colombo. Protesters demanded that Rajapaksa step down and take responsibility for the country's economic crisis. The island nation has witnessed demonstrations on an almost daily basis since late March, with protesters accusing the president and his family of mishandling the economy. Sri Lanka is grappling with a severe shortage of foreign exchange, which has negatively affected its economy and caused hardships to import fuel, food, and medicines. And Iran has set in motion its legal pursuit of Canada's unilateral cancellation of its football match with Iran. Canada called the friendly match 10 days before it was set to take place in Vancouver. Youssef Jaloli reports from Tehran.
It was planned as a friendly soccer match, but turned into a political dispute. Canada has unilaterally pulled out of a World Cup warm-up match it had planned with Iran on June 5th in Vancouver. Citing, quote, untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran, the Canadian footballing body Canada Soccer called off the match, which had sold 40,000 tickets already. Here in Iran, the move has created a whirlwind, with Iranian sports authorities calling it illegal and unsporting.
Sportsmanship and fairness is a fundamental principle in sports. Canada's decision to unilaterally cancel the fixture violates the principle. On the other hand, the move has tarnished Canada's image on the world's athletic stage, because no one would trust a country that has apathetically scrapped a formal contract.
The Iranian team was slated to arrive in Canada on Wednesday to take part in the exhibition match. Canada Soccer had said it chose Iran because the team had a similar playing style to Morocco, one of Canada's opponents, and the Qatar FIFA World Cup. But aside from missing this rare chance, Canada Soccer now has to pay the financial costs of the sold-out tickets.
It seems that Canada's unilateral cancellation of its match with Iran will produce more long-term ripple effects, as there are financial dimensions to it, not to mention the legal ramifications. Iran has now decided to sue Canada for breach of contract and, quote, politicizing sports.
Youssef Jaloli, Tehran.
That's a wrap with this hour's World News. Thanks for your company. Stay with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
Doubts about Boris Johnson's ability to survive as Britain's Prime Minister and fears that the Tories are now on a terminal electoral slide grew as party grandee Sir Bob Neale said the combination of collapsing trust in the Prime Minister coupled with a lack of clarity over what the Conservatives stood for had created a toxic mix in the minds of voters. We now present you an article written jointly by Toby Helm, Michael Savage and Philip Inman. The piece is titled Party grandees warn Boris Johnson is trashing Tory identity. As more British MPs called Boris Johnson to resign as Prime Minister, senior Tories warned recently he has plunged the Conservative Party into an acute identity crisis as a result of the Partygate scandal and U-turns over tax policy. Former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith told The Observer his party had been left with an enormous identity problem because it had raised taxes instead of cutting them under Boris Johnson and the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, undermining a core Tory message that had helped win its successive general elections. Doubts about Boris Johnson's ability to survive as Prime Minister and fears that the Tories are now on a terminal electoral slide grew as party grandee Sir Bob Neill said the combination of collapsing trust in the Prime Minister coupled with a lack of clarity over what the Conservatives stood for had created a toxic mix in the minds of voters. Sir Bob Neill called on Friday, 27th of May, for Boris Johnson to go. Recently, two more MPs, former Health Minister Steve Bryan and Anne-Marie Morris, said they had also lost confidence in Prime Minister Boris Johnson, taking the total who have gone public to 24. Several others are understood to have written letters of no confidence to 1922 Chair Sir Graham Brady without going public, and more have privately indicated they will do so. If 54 or more MPs submit letters of no confidence to Sir Graham Brady, a leadership contest will be triggered. One rebel MP said, "I reckon we're in the 40s. Another added, "We're just a few off." Thursday, 26th of May and Friday, 27th of May, there was a mood of relief bordering on jubilation in Downing Street as Boris Johnson and his team believed they had survived the publication of a damaging report on Partygate by the senior civil servant Sue Gray, and then switched focus onto measures to address the cost of living crisis on Thursday. While a £15 billion package of measures announced by Rishi Sunak was broadly welcomed, many Tories were unhappy that the government funded part of it by performing a massive U-turn, which saw it adopt Labour's plan for a windfall tax on the profits of oil and gas companies. Ian Duncan Smith said that instead of imposing a tax rise on businesses, the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, should have cut taxes for middle and lower earners and restored the Tory reputation as a low taxation party. Ian Duncan Smith said, "He had the headroom not to do a windfall tax. Getting growth going is the priority. We have to avoid recession, and to do that, we have to lower taxes and get people spending." Ian Duncan Smith added, "Conservatives believe in lower taxes, leaving people with more of their own money because they make the best choices. Unless we get back to this approach and cut taxes in the autumn budget, we're in real trouble." He said the Tories now risked earning a reputation for being a high-tax, big-state party, having also raised national insurance in breach of a manifesto commitment. He noted, "I don't just think we have a bit of an identity problem, we have a massive identity problem." Gavin Barwell, the former Tory MP who served as Theresa May's chief of staff at No. 10 Downing Street, said the party's electoral prospects under Boris Johnson were grim. "By failing to take action against the Prime Minister, approximately 60% of the public think should resign, Conservative MPs are sleepwalking to defeat at the next election." The latest opinion poll for The Observer finds that 56% of all British voters, including 32% of 2019 Tory voters, believe that Boris Johnson should resign. The opinion poll was conducted after publication of Sue Gray's report. Oliver Heal, the Tory MP for North East Hertfordshire, told constituents that he was talking with fellow MPs about what happens next. He added, "I think it will take 2 or 3 weeks to know the answer. Key by-elections in Wakefield and in Tiverton and Honiton take place in 3 weeks." Former Cabinet Minister Robert Buckland said on Saturday, 28th of May, that changes will have to be made if the party suffers heavy defeats. The Liberal Democrats say many of those calling for Boris Johnson to resign are in Tory seats that they are targeting. The Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, said Conservative MPs who spend months defending Boris Johnson over Partygate are now finally acting because they're worried about losing their seats. Daisy Cooper added, "This by-election in Tiverton and Honiton is a chance to send a clear message that people won't stand for Boris Johnson's lies and law-breaking and that he has to go. If we can overturn the huge Tory majority, the trickle of letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister could turn into a flood." Johnson caused further astonishment on Friday, 27th of May, just 2 days after declaring himself to have been humbled by Sue Gray's report, when it was announced that he had written parts of the Ministerial Code of Conduct so that ministers no longer have to resign for minor breaches of the code. He also removed a section of the code which referred to ethics. The Labour Party on Saturday announced it would hold an Opposition Day debate in which the party would pledge to strengthen the Code of Conduct. In a further potential blow to the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, doubts are being raised recently about whether the windfall tax will raise anywhere near the £5 billion that the Chancellor claimed it would on Thursday, 26th of May. The left-of-centre Commonwealth think tank said he may only raise a fraction of that sum because of complex rules which allow investments to be offset against profits. The warning comes after the Liberal Democrats said delays to the tax's introduction meant he had missed out on £3 billion from the extraordinary profits reported by oil and gas firms in 2021 and another £8 billion so far this year.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the sharp spike in violence, harassment and persecution of minority Muslims in Hindu-majority India and an uncertain future for the country. We shall also take a look at the Indian government's decision to ban the export of wheat amid the food crisis gripping the world, angering the wealthiest countries.
The incidents of violence, harassment and persecution of Muslims are snowballing across India as the Narendra Modi government completes its 8 years in power. In recent months, there have been communal clashes and arrests of Muslims in different parts of the country, from Madhya Pradesh to West Bengal to New Delhi. Instead of dousing the flames of violence and hatred, the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has been accused of fanning those flames and pushing the world's largest democracy towards a dark and uncertain future.
Hindu religious processions moving through predominantly Muslim neighborhoods, saffron flags being hoisted on mosques, swords being brandished during Hindu festivals, bulldozers rolling into Muslim neighborhoods to raze buildings to the ground. Violence against the minority Muslim community in India is usually portrayed as spontaneous, but these incidents are more often meticulously planned. On April the 20th, a convoy of bulldozers rolled into a North Delhi neighborhood, razing several buildings to the ground, including the entrance gate of a mosque as well as homes and shops belonging to Muslims. Local authorities claimed the structures were being razed for being illegal, but they prevented a bulldozer from bringing down the entrance of a Hindu temple barely 50 meters from the mosque. It was evident that the campaign was aimed at a particular community to destroy their homes, livelihoods, and places of worship as part of a diabolic plan to wipe out their identity. The incident came days after communal violence broke out in the same area when Hindutva gangs attempted to hoist the saffron flag on a local mosque. These incidents are not confined to the Indian capital, though. Similar incidents have been reported from Madhya Pradesh, Jharkhand, Bihar, West Bengal, etc. The brazenness of radical Hindu groups is disturbing, and the government's inaction is scandalous.
Communal riots have taken place throughout India's history. In the past, governments used to discourage such eruptions through condemnations and compensations. That's no longer the case. Since the BJP government rose to power in 2014, anti-Muslim activities have virtually got an official sanction. The party today rules both at the centre in India and in about half of India's states. The top BJP leaders tend to believe that to remain in power, it needs to mount majoritarianism and political polarization in order to lay the foundation of a Hindu nation.
This month, Narendra Modi completes 8 years as India's Prime Minister. During his term in office, there has been a careful attempt to convince the majority Hindu community that the country's biggest problem is its Muslims. The panacea for all problems lies in turning India into a Hindu Rashtra, a term coined by the ideological godfather of Hindu fanatics, Vinayak Savarkar. Modi and his acolytes have taken it upon themselves to turn Savarkar's dream into a reality. Before the Hindu Nationalist Party assumed power in 2014, many people thought their main concerns were poverty, economic recession and corruption. Modi promised to address the problems, but while the economy has deteriorated under him, his party has increasingly fallen back on hate-filled, supremacist politics to deflect attention and avoid responsibility. According to an independent hate crime tracker, in the last 4 years alone, over 400 hate crimes were carried out against Muslims in India. The organizations at the forefront of anti-Muslim violence include Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal, both of them linked to the ruling party. In the name of celebrating Hindu festivals, they have carried out organized violence against Muslims in different Indian states, and their leaders have made open calls for abduction, rape, and genocide of Muslims. And the juggernaut rolls on.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee from London, UK. Now, welcome to the program, sir. Now, since the Hindu Nationalist BJP came to power in 2014, Indian Muslims have had to change the way they dress, eat, and even speak in public. Now, how difficult is it to be a Muslim in India today?
It's not only difficult to be a Muslim in India today, it's also getting harder and harder to fight for equal treatment for Muslims as well. So in MPAC UK, we regularly host events where we invite speakers to talk about the situation in India, and activists tell us how it's just getting harder for them to stand up for Muslims' rights. They get singled out for punishment because they're known for criticising the current and historic Hindu supremacy in India. There was one event where one of our speakers, Sharjil Usmani, he couldn't even attend to speak because he was on the run from the police because of how he had worded one speech. That's the level of the absurdity of the scrutiny that Muslims face in India.
Mr. Hussain, BJP has moved to turn Mahatma Gandhi's secular India into a Hindu nation by othering the country's largest minority group. Now, do you think the appeasement of Hindus and the alienation of Muslims works as a political strategy?
Look at the 2002 Gujarat pogroms, when Muslims were vilified so thoroughly that the BJP governor only had to say a few words and the whole region erupted in arson and looting and rape. That governor was Modi, who continued his policy of appeasing one side and alienating the other, and he became prime minister. And India has erupted again and again in 2020 with the Delhi riots and the farmers' protests, because the issues of poverty and societal breakdown don't get resolved by scapegoating Muslims and Sikhs and other minorities. Any politician whose strategy it is to divide and conquer is a danger to their own country.
Mr. Hussain, Muslim bashing has become Modi government's unstated policy, which can be seen from statements of ministers and MPs. Now, do you think the absence of strong political opposition has emboldened the BJP government to tear apart the country's rich secular democratic ethos?
As with any bully, they are empowered every time they get away with their attacks. And I say this because I want your viewers to appreciate that you cannot understand modern India without understanding what India has been doing to Kashmir. Kashmir has been a guinea pig, a punching bag, a political football, no matter which party was running India. That's meant that no major party in India has the moral ground to stand up against BJP's ethno-nationalism, because they've all aided and abetted the same ideology in Kashmir. If we want to see a restrained BJP across India, then we have to see justice for Kashmir too.
Mr. Hussain, as we know, there is no legal ban on wearing religious dress in public places in India, but Muslim women wearing hijab still face backlash and discrimination. So why does this piece of cloth give so much jitters to the ruling elites in India?
That's because India's ruling BJP have no solutions for the people. They only have myths and symbols to try and placate their voter base. So they see something that looks like a symbol of Islam, the headscarf, and they zero in on it as a distraction for their voter base. But look, if the BJP were actually serious about women's rights, they would do something about the police force and their problem of kidnapping and then raping and then blackmailing women, which is something that many human rights organizations have written many times about.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, what does the future hold for Muslims in India, especially the younger generation? And do you see a silver lining in dark clouds?
I've mentioned the events that MPAC UK have done highlighting the oppression of Indian Muslims. So I've seen for myself that the young generation of activists, they have the brains to understand the root causes of their oppression. They have the spine to stand up for their freedoms. And honestly, their example is something that Muslims over here in the UK and Europe can learn from, alhamdulillah. But what they need more of, what every Muslim needs, is solidarity with the oppressed, with all oppressed people, because their pain is our pain, and their freedom one day will be our freedom too.
Mr. Hussain, thank you for being on the program once again.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's see how people have reacted on social media on the violence, harassment and persecution of Muslims.
Khalid Beydoun, a law professor and author, says more Arabs and non-South Asian Muslims need to speak up on Hindutva terror in India, as Indian Muslims have always spoken up on Yemen, Palestine and Islamophobia in France. Senior Indian journalist Arfa Khanum Sharwani points to the difficulty of being a Muslim in today's India, urging the world to pay attention to the lives they are living under the Hindu nationalist BJP government. Ashok Swain, a Sweden-based Indian academic, refers to the closure of a mosque in Varanasi city to stress that Indian Muslims are struggling to survive under a majoritarian regime and highly partisan police force and judiciary.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In an interesting volte-face, India has banned the export of its wheat, partly due to the raging war in Ukraine and also the scorching heat wave curtailing output and pushing domestic prices to record highs. The populist move has been linked to the country's food security, as India, despite being the world's second largest producer of wheat, faces massive domestic food demand. This comes after India was initially eyeing as much as 12 million tons of wheat exports in 2022-23, significantly higher than last year's record exports of 7.2 million tons.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, during his talks with US President Joe Biden on April the 13th, said India was capable of feeding the world and filling the gap created by the Ukraine war. A month later, his government banned the export of wheat, shocking the world, including his own farmers. India, the second largest producer of wheat in the world, exported 8.2 million tons of wheat in the year leading to March 2022. The Modi government claimed that India could export anywhere between 10 and 15 million tons in the current fiscal year that ends March 2023. So far, less than 5 million tons have been contracted for exports, significantly less than the target. The move to ban exports is widely seen as part of a wave of protectionism sweeping the world in the backdrop of the Ukraine war. The knee-jerk decision came after the Indian government failed to buy enough wheat for its massive food security program, about 18 million tons compared with nearly 44 million tons last year. That was largely due to high exports and relatively lower harvest as the scorching heat wave affected the yield. Rising food inflation also prompted New Delhi to reverse its decision.
India's ban on wheat exports has dealt a fresh blow to world markets at a time when the global buyers were banking on supplies from the world's second largest wheat producer. Low supplies from Canada, Europe and Australia and snarled supply lines in the war-torn Black Sea area have led to a rise in food prices, mostly hitting poor consumers in Asia and Africa. With the world's wealthiest countries denouncing New Delhi's knee-jerk decision, officials in India have pointed to the hypocrisy of the West, urging them to stop wasting food.
Although India is not one of the world's top wheat exporters, the ban is likely to push global food prices to new peaks, according to observers. Among those who have slammed the decision are the world's wealthiest countries. The move was denounced by agriculture ministers from the G7 industrialized nations, with German agriculture minister Cem Özdemir saying it would worsen the crisis. In response, Indian officials advised wealthy nations to stop wasting food and said New Delhi makes up less than 1% of global wheat exports. As per the UN Environment Program, the U.S. ranks 59 in terms of household food waste estimate per kilogram on capita every year, while Japan, Italy and Germany are at 64, 67 and 75 respectively, an Indian official was cited as saying. Some even pointed to the hypocrisy of G7 countries, recalling how the U.S., under the America First policy, banned the export of not just vaccines, but also raw materials required for their production in 2021. Among top destinations for Indian exports are Bangladesh, Indonesia, Nepal, and Turkey. And top global buyer Egypt also agreed recently to make a first-ever purchase of Indian wheat. Russia, Europe, US, and Canada are the top global wheat exporters, accounting for roughly 60% of world wheat exports.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Mushtaq Lashari, the founder and chairman of Third World Solidarity, based in London, UK. Welcome to the programme, sir. Now, Mr. Lashari, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi last month offered to help mitigate the global wheat deficit and, quote, feed the world. What has prompted New Delhi now to ban the export of this commodity?
I think, and we all know, what is the Narendra Modi's attitude toward the people of the world, whether it is human rights or whether it is related to food or anything. His main objective is to promote his populist Hindutva sort of policies. And he's doing it again. He wants to take, negotiate some sort of facilitation from the Western world, which will be affected. Because as you know, in third world countries or in developing world, these issues are not so relevant to the democracies. But wherever there is a democracy, if the prices go high, as it is going already high in United Kingdom, it is 9% inflation this year, while they can't increase the salaries of the people to 9%. So they are already facing a lot of unpopularity. And same is happening in USA. So what they will try to do is, while, as you say, there is a crisis going on because of the war in between Russia and Ukraine, or Ukraine fighting back Russia, there is already shortage of many commodities, including wheat, soya oil, and many. So the prices will jump. And because of the gas issues, there is a price hike in everywhere in the Europe, in Western world, in UK, because of that. And I think India and a few other countries who have some influence or some thing they can do with these prices by allowing the people to export, they will try to get their maximum benefits from these countries. But he wants to remain popular in the country, and that's why he's trying to do it. And I know that the peasants and farmers are not happy with it, because they want to get benefit of it. And if he carries on with this ban, they can't export. And if they can't export it, their prices in the country where they have a surplus wheat and other things, that will drop.
Mr. Lashari, as we know, India is the world's second largest producer of wheat after China. Now, does this decision hurt the credibility of the Modi government and convey a message that it does not have a credible export policy?
Definitely it will. Although the Western world has no choice, America, Britain and other countries, because at the moment their target is China. But I think still it will harm the standing and status of India in the world, which will definitely, in my opinion, affect Modi's credibility in the world. And if he loses the credibility, it is not easy to establish again your credibility. So it will definitely affect the Indian credibility and status in the world.
Mr. Lashari, India's move, along with dwindling supplies from Russia and Ukraine, have sent wheat prices soaring in the international market. What could be its possible repercussions?
I think that because Ukraine and Russia are already being excluded from the world by sanctions and other things which are sanctioned, basically. Ukraine is getting a lot of support, financial and militarily, but Russia is being excluded and isolated in the world at the moment by putting a lot of sanctions. Although it is very difficult to implement those sanctions, but India can be a next target if India continues it, and that will be very difficult to sustain for Indian economy.
Sir, do you think the scathing criticism from G7 industrialized nations over the decision to ban the export of wheat could prompt India to revise its decision?
I personally believe that Modi is very weak. He would not sustain if G7 continues the pressure on them to allow to export the wheat. I don't think Indian economy, politically, socially, and economically can sustain the pressure from the Western world or from G7.
Last but not least, sir, how does this populist move affect farmers and traders in India who are apparently not happy?
Oh, basically, they are the people who elected Modi. He has been twice elected with a majority or popular vote. And if it economically affect the people of India, his popularity will go down. And he's already being criticized by the world or G7 and others by not looking after the minorities. This will be another issue which will affect him. But in my opinion, Modi might resist it because he knows that he's old. This is his last term, in my opinion. You never know, because in our part of the world, there is no restriction of continuing for third and fourth and fifth term. But I think he will definitely look at it, and it is possible that he will take a U-turn.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Lashari for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people think of India's ban on wheat exports amid global food crisis.
Former Indian diplomat M.K. Bhadrakumar slams Western pundits for criticizing India's decision to ban the export of wheat, arguing that all countries give primacy to the welfare of their own citizens. Minhas Merchant, a senior journalist and author, calls India's reaction to the criticism of G7 countries as tight slap, saying the industrialized nations ignore the fact that the move aims to ensure India's food security. Former Indian military officer Brigadier Mahalingam, responding to the statement by German agriculture minister over India's ban on wheat exports, urges him to ask the US to lift sanctions to allow free flow of commodities.
And that was our episode about the BJP government's anti-Muslim policies in India and New Delhi's move to ban the export of wheat. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
The Iraqi parliament, which ruled that any attempt by treacherous elements to enter into any kind of relationship with the illegal Zionist entity could end in lifetime prison sentences or even the death penalty, called on parliaments of Arab and other Muslim countries to follow the Iraqi lead by passing similar legislations that meets the aspirations of their people. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Iraqi enactment accelerates end of Israel's illegal existence. Here's the story. Iraqi Muslims have not only reaffirmed their religious and national identities, But as key members of the resistance front have reiterated their resolve to the weeding out of the cancerous tumor called Israel from the West Asian region. The recent approval by the Iraqi parliament of the law titled Criminalizing Normalization and Establishment of Relations with the Illegal Zionist Entity was also a firm slap on the face of the unrepresentative regimes of the Persian Gulf and Arab Africa, which as clients of the U.S. have backstabbed the Palestinian people by setting up diplomatic ties with usurper Israel. Kudos to the Iraqi people and to the parliament, which said the legislation represents a true reflection of the will of the people and a brave national decision.